In the name of emotional well-being, college students are increasingly demanding protection from words and ideas they don't like. So starts the cover story in the September issue of The Atlantic, The Coddling of the American Mind. We will talk with one of the co-authors of this piece about why he says this is bad for education and bad for the student's mental health. And we will welcome your questions, your concerns, and your experiences. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Do you think college students should be warned about the sexual or traumatic content that might be in their college courses? Should they be issued so-called trigger warnings? That's apparently happening more and more. How about discussing and discouraging microaggressions, phrases that some find offensive? What do we think about that? Is this coddling our college students to be concerned about issues like this? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. We have, by the way, linked the article, The Coddling of the American Mind, to the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Our guest is Greg Lukianoff, a constitutional lawyer and the president and CEO of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. His article with co-author Jonathan Haidt, The Coddling of the American Mind, is September's cover story in The Atlantic. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, first, explain more what you mean by the coddling of the American mind.
Well, you know, that's the title of the piece, and what we're talking about in it is actually that we believe the way we're teaching a generation to argue with each other is not only problematic for open discourse and inquiry, but that it's also potentially psychologically harmful. And one point that I really want to emphasize is that although a lot of people have been focusing on the students in our article, I really think that they've learned a lot of these lessons from years of administrators, for example, engaged in a cognitive distortion known as catastrophizing, for example, acting as if any small thing that happens is actually something worthy of immediate emergency response.
Can you give us some examples of catastrophizing?
I can give you. I wrote a book called Unlearning Liberty that came out in 2012. That was one of the only critiques of it was that it had too many examples in it. But I'll give you one, for example. There was a professor at a college in northern New Jersey. He posted, and this was just last year, he posted a picture of his daughter wearing a Game of Thrones t-shirt that quotes Daenerys Targaryen saying, "I will take what is mine with fire and blood." It's a great moment for Daenerys in the show, by the way. It's like when she kind of finds her power. And he put it on Google+. Maybe that was the problem, that he put it on Google+. But an administrator saw this. Somehow managed to interpret this as some kind of threat to the entire community, likened fire that could be a reference to AK-47s, put the professor immediately on leave, and demanded that he get psychological counseling.
Yeah, well, what's the big deal if this happens?
What's the big deal if this happens?
Yeah.
The professors are getting put on leave when they put pictures of their children.
Right, no, that's bad for that professor, but why is it bad for education and mental health?
I think it actually teaches students that smart people overreact to things, that essentially that we are constantly and always and at all times in grave danger. And frankly, we're not. So when you have situations like, you know, the story that opens up my first book, Unlearning Liberty, is a student who was immediately expelled for putting up a collage criticizing the he's an environmentalist, criticizing the decision to put up a parking garage. And he referred to it as the President Zachary Memorial Parking Garage. What he didn't know was that university professor had been looking for, that university president had been looking for a reason to punish this student for weeks before because he didn't like his criticism of the parking garage. And since it had the word memorial in it, the university professor claimed that that was a threat upon his life. This led to a student being kicked out of school. So, so that was really disastrous for that student. It was also wildly unconstitutional. The university just settled for nearly $1 million in that case. But I think more dangerously, it teaches students that smart, responsible adults overreact to speech in a way that indicates that we're constantly in danger.
You know, we did a program, boy, maybe not even just a few weeks ago, on microaggressions.
Right.
And one of the University of Wisconsin campuses using a list of microaggressions in its new faculty training to say this could be found offensive to various students if you ask them, for example, where are you from?
Right.
The college says they are not banning any language, just making faculty aware of this. Why are microaggressions are also a part of the coddling of the American mind?
Well, we talk about it in the article under the framework of cognitive behavioral therapy and cognitive distortions. And one of the big cognitive distortions is the idea of magnification, the idea that you take something that might be a relatively small, for example, slight, and you magnify it and fixate it in your head. Now, in CBT, you're taught not to do that because it makes you both anxious and depressed. And what we talk about and the sort of the innovation of the piece is to apply some of the idea of cognitive distortions, which honestly university students should be learning anyway because they're also just good ways to argue and good ways to think. But microaggressions, what we argue in the piece, are partially, potentially a way of teaching people to constantly be looking for potential slights. Meanwhile, when it comes to the different microaggression programs that have been passed, some of them are actually, more policing than others. There's a program at Ithaca College that they're still hammering out, but that is very much one that they try to reassure people that they're not going to prosecute everyone who says something that's unconsciously slighting, with, of course, the strong implication that, so you're going to prosecute some people if anything they say is perceived as being slighting?
Yeah, and because to me this was not necessarily coming from the students, this was coming from the administration.
For most of my career, most of the problems that we see have been from sort of over-administration, trying to sort of regulate every aspect of student lives. But in the Ithaca case, for example, this was actually coming from students themselves, from actually a small number of students themselves.
Yeah. And talk about the trigger warnings. I didn't even know. What is a trigger warning?
Yeah, trigger warnings, it's interesting. It's a small section of the piece, but you would think from some of the reaction on the Internet that that's all we wrote about in the article. But trigger warnings are small warnings that you give, that a professor can give before discussing a book or a movie that might be emotionally traumatic. Now, the classic example that people give is, for example, if someone has survived rape and you're going to be talking about a book that has rape in it, that you might say, trigger warning, there's sexual assault in this. But the problem with trigger warnings is that it puts professors in a relatively impossible position because it's important to remember that the definition of what requires trigger warnings has just grown and grown and grown and grown. So when they successfully passed the policy to this effect at Oberlin College, university professors were horrified because the list of things that would require trigger warnings and also the list of things that they were discouraged from discussing at all in class included things like colonialism and racism and classism and sexism. And it's hard, if you're teaching about these issues or if you're teaching literature, for goodness sakes, to actually try to figure out everything that you might need to provide a warning in advance for.
We are talking with Greg Lukianoff. He is one of the co-authors of the September cover story in The Atlantic, The Coddling of the American Mind. 1-800-642-1234 if you have a question or an example you'd like to share or a concern. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. So let's talk a little bit more on what are the problems that this coddling could lead to, Greg.
Well, I think that we're teaching students, and we've been teaching students for a long time, that they're far more fragile and they're far less resilient than they actually are. And the problem with that is that can actually lead to sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy where people actually believe that they are more fragile than they are. And that's one of the reasons why we talk about some of the tools of cognitive behavioral therapy. Now, I'm going to take a little moment to explain the method of cognitive behavioral therapy. Basically, cognitive behavioral therapy recognizes the fact that particularly when you're anxious and depressed, people tend to distort what's going on in their head. So, for example, you know, classic one would be, you know, if I fail this interview, my life is over. If this person breaks up with me, I will never date again. All of these kind of things that pretty much everybody says. But some psychologists several decades ago realized that anxious and depressed people had this really negative interior dialogue. So they set up a program where essentially all you do is you write down what are called your automatic thoughts, and you evaluate them rationally, and you ask yourself, is this a cognitive distortion? Am I engaged in, for example, dichotomous thinking, which is all or nothing? Either I'm a wonderful success or I'm a horrible failure. And that's frankly unfair, and it's irrational. And the amazing thing about CBT is it's the most successful intervention, non-drug intervention for anxiety and depression at this point. And all it is really is learning how to argue fairly with your interior dialogue. I want to emphasize here. I used to suffer from very bad depressions before I started doing CBT, and it was incredibly effective for me. I think it probably saved my life. And the idea, what we're saying here is that applying some thinking from CBT to the way we argue with each other, not just the way we argue with our interior dialogue, is good for debate, good for discussion, but also might have the advantage of making students less anxious and depressed.
We welcome your questions and experiences for our guest, the co-author of The Coddling of the American Mind, at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. Talking about microaggressions and the policing of microaggressions on campuses could be a part of contributing to an erosion of critical thinking skills, issuing so-called trigger warnings that there might be content in a college course that could upset some students. Should students be warned about things like this? We are talking about the coddling of college students' minds, and we'll talk more about what we can do about this after this break. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking with the co-author of The Coddling of the American Mind, which is the September cover story in The Atlantic. Greg Lukianoff is a constitutional lawyer and the president and CEO of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. And we're talking about how college students and, in some cases, college administrators are demanding protection from words and ideas that they don't like, and talking about how this can be hurtful for the student and for education in general. Let's take some calls. Let's go to Victor in West Dallas. Hi, Victor.
Hi, Jason. Enjoying your program. I have a couple questions for you. How is this new regulation going to affect the base? When I went to college, we used to argue or debate between from A to Z. And last week, we had a beautiful guest, and would just fall into the same category, were religion/science. So how would this affect the kind of on-campus debates that I'm so used to being 70 years old, and that's kind of service became a hippie. But the point is, how would this affect upcoming debates among students?
So is it affecting debates on issues like, you know, I don't know, religion versus science, Greg?
Sure. I wrote a short book called Freedom from Speech last year, where I talk about the phenomenon of disinvitation movements. And they made a big splash in the news, partially because really high-profile people from Bill Maher to Condoleezza Rice to Christine Lagarde to Robert Birgenau, former president of Berkeley, were facing pushes to be disinvited from campus, usually to give commencement addresses. But we did a ton of research on this over the course of the past year, and we found that actually more often than not, it's not commencement addresses at all. It's actually debates and discussions that get pushes for this debater to not be invited. A really sort of telltale example of this was an older case back at UCLA where a bunch of open borders libertarian students wanted to have a debate about immigration. And again, these are open borders people, but they wanted to have someone on the other side of it. And the fact that they were going to invite someone who was anti-immigration come to campus led to protests and led the university to demand $5,000 in security fees, which they knew the students couldn't pay if they wanted to have the con side of the debate. Now, this is unconstitutional. We wrote the university saying, like, listen, you're not really pulling a fast one here. You can't sort of fine your way out of a debate. But we found it so striking that just the debate, to have both sides of a debate fairly represented, was considered to be that controversial.
Is this mainly liberal college students saying, I don't want to hear another point of view?
In a lot of cases, unfortunately, yes. And I mean, I consider myself a political liberal, but I've seen this in a lot of cases coming from liberal students. But not exclusively, though. Certainly when there are pushes to get people disinvited from off campus, it tends to be the other way around. So I had an interesting case also that I talk about in Unlearning Liberty, where the Oklahoma legislature got together to try to get Richard Dawkins disinvited because he believed in I think the terms they used was an unpopular and unproven theory of evolution, and therefore should not be allowed to speak on campus.
Yeah. So, I'm trying to figure out where did this come from? I mean, this wasn't going on when Victor was in school back in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So he says that, you know, that's the kind of debates he had. What happened that we're seeing this now and we didn't then?
Well, you know, my theory in freedom from speech is that generally as societies get more affluent, as they get more comfortable, and particularly as they have better opportunities to avoid ideas they dislike. So if you can, like, listen all day to whether it's, you can listen to Glenn Beck all day or you can listen to MSNBC all day, that people get less trained in being able to handle debate and dissent. And we also, by the way, live increasingly even in blocks and communities that are more politically homogeneous than they were, say, 30 years ago. So I actually, unfortunately, see this as a natural progression of what otherwise is actually relatively good things. You know, the fact that we are able to choose where we live is wonderful. That we can live in communities that share our own values is wonderful. The fact that we're, you know, more comfortable than my father, who was born in 1926 in Yugoslavia, is wonderful. But it does have a little bit of a dark side in that we get we come more to expect, you know, confirmation and people to agree with us than we do. And if nobody's actually training us, that no, debate, like meaningful debate, talking to people that you disagree on the very heart of the matter is actually a good thing. If they're not teaching you that, there's no reason why you should gravitate towards it.
Yeah. Do you also point a finger to helicopter parenting, don't you?
Yeah, we do think that the problem of helicopter parenting, as well covered by the famous Lenore Skenazy, she wrote a great book called Free Range Kids, and she runs a website called Free Range Kids, talking about sort of the excessive over-parenting of students, which she thinks actually does also produce this thinking in students' heads that I live in this very dangerous world that adults must constantly protect me from. And what's interesting is, of course, well, we live in a much less dangerous world than, for example, the one that any of us were born into, and that some of this thinking, I think that there's constantly sort of a catastrophe, is not only unhealthy, it's unwarranted.
Our next caller is Paul in Madison. Hi, Paul.
Hi, thanks for the show. My question was, how much of this do you think comes from colleges basically trying to protect themselves from litigation lawsuits and spending money on managing these types of issues? And if that's the case, how do you kind of bridge that divide between, you know, the administrative realm, you know, working for in the school's interest and the academic realm, you know, fully educating the students and doing the best on their behalf?
I am so glad you brought that up. That is such an excellent question, and it's a point that I like to make, but it got lost in all the different points. I honestly think an awful lot of the reason why this goes from maybe like a volume of 6 to a volume of 11 is partially fear of litigation that in some cases is overblown, and in some cases is fair. And one of the things that we advocate in the course of the article is just clear rules for example, the Office of Civil Rights of the Department of Education. In the past couple of years, they have come out with some very confusing, very difficult to apply, to actually live up to, and in some cases you'd run into possible lawsuits even if you tried to, regulations for universities. And one of the things that we've been recommending that's actually I think is actually a very humble and simple idea is, for example, in the area of harassment and discrimination, that universities should use the definition as provided by the Supreme Court. Now, that sounds like, well, of course they would use the definition as provided by the Supreme Court. But unfortunately, that's not what they're currently doing. They're sort of making up their own definitions that are sometimes so vague and so broad, it's led to literally dozens of lawsuits over the past several years, some of them, frankly, brought by my organization because we oppose speech codes that the define harassment so broadly as to sweep in huge swaths of clearly protected speech. So legal clarity would help a great deal with a lot of this. And I also think that there's this great statement that Jeffrey Stone, who's the dean of University of Chicago Law School, has been promulgating about concepts of academic freedom. And I think that if more schools were to adopt that, so far Princeton has adopted it, University of Chicago has adopted it, Purdue has adopted it, I think Wisconsin should adopt it, because it's reminding people of the centrality and importance of being able to have uncomfortable, difficult discussions and hearing people we disagree with. Now, how will that help with regards to legal clarity? I think it helps tell institutions, I think it helps tell the Department of Education that universities do still continue to keep this as their main priority.
Yeah, I'm going to be honest. I have a jackhammer pounding away behind me doing some construction. I hope listeners can't hear it. But what should Wisconsin adopt?
There's a statement that University of Chicago, Professor Jeffrey Stone and a whole team of other professors came up with, a statement about academic freedom that they just released in January. That is, this probably the best statement on academic freedom that I think has been authored in my career. There are great statements by the American Association of University Professors that go back to 1915, but within my own lifetime, this is the best one I've seen, and I think it's a great way to tell students and professors that, to a degree, yes, we try to be compassionate to students, but in an intellectual sense, universities are not really necessarily supposed to be safe places. They're supposed to be challenging places.
So can you generally tell us what that statement says?
I think it's I summarized it pretty well. I mean, it's best to look it up. It's about 2 pages. I'd be happy to link for the listeners.
Well, maybe we should look it up and we can put it on our Facebook page so people can take a look at exactly what it says. We are talking with Greg Lukianoff. He is a constitutional lawyer and the president and CEO of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. He is a co-author of the cover story in the September issue of The Atlantic, The Coddling of the American Mind. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. We have Gail on Facebook who says, rather than banning discourse that includes microaggressions about racism and sexism, we need to have conversations about it. The very definition of microaggressions is essentially things that people say that they don't realize are offensive. So we need to be educated about that rather than having that kind of language and discourse completely removed. You can't learn if you don't talk about it.
I could not agree more. And when people do talk about safe spaces on college campuses, the thing that I try to emphasize is if you have people from genuinely different backgrounds, particularly from different class backgrounds or from different countries, they're going to have very different ideas about what's appropriate to say. So sometimes these attempts to sort of police microaggressions, they end up being, in the name of diversity, they end up being very sort of parochial. It's kind of like, this is the way we think people should talk to each other. And what I think we need to create are safe spaces in which students can talk to each other without fear of getting in trouble for saying what they honestly believe. But unfortunately, I think if we over-police speech, you end up discouraging people talking across lines of differences rather than encouraging it. And if there isn't a safe space to be wrong from time to time, people aren't going to bother opening their mouths.
Todd in Appleton is with us now. Hi, Todd. I'm sorry, Todd, go ahead.
Yes. Discussing all the different things that we expose college students to, I came home from the military in 1970 and went back to college in a small liberal arts college. And one of the things that we talked about in English literature class, even though it was a grade school book, was Uncle Tom's Cabin. And I understand there's an effort now to remove, which is we all know is a very, very bad word to hear, is the N-word. However, given the flavor of that book and why it was written, which basically launched the whole movement of abolitionism, during the 1800s, it needed to stay in there simply to get the flavor of the book. And I understand now there's an effort to censor those words from the book and therefore probably eliminate the whole reason the book was written. And things like that have been happening that kind of bothers me a little bit about what people are really learning as to how unpleasant things have been as part of our history.
Yep. I completely agree, and I think you're right that it's extremely short-sighted. That there's some, and again, it seems incredibly parochial that we have nothing to learn from the way people used to talk to each other. Is I think kind of crazy. Meanwhile, kind of like of course Huck Finn and Tom Sawyer come up a lot, and the idea of censoring those books so people can't see the language that Mark Twain actually wrote with is just so tragic because they're some of the great anti-racist books ever written.
What would you say though to, I don't know, let's say that that there are students who are hurt by constantly being considered like they're the other, or that they don't belong there, or that they're only there because of affirmative action.
Sure.
And I mean, isn't there a way to deal with the issues the microaggressions are trying to deal with?
Yeah, and this is one thing I want to be clear on, and we only in 8,000 words we had 100,000 words worth of stuff to say, but we do spend a little bit of time explaining. I think microaggressions are a really interesting topic. I think they're absolutely worthy of research to try to figure out how people unconsciously slight each other, or how people perceive that they're unconsciously slighted even when that isn't intended. And I think the right way to do it is to look at it, is to study it. But when you have things that actually sort of police unconscious slights, one, they start actually sort of spiraling out of control to a degree. I mean, the University of New Hampshire had to withdraw a list of microaggressions that included, among things that could be problematic language, aka microaggressions, would be using the term American or using the term Arab, which I just couldn't believe they just put it all by itself. That how deeply offensive is the idea that calling someone who might be Arabic Arab is itself a microaggression. It reminded me of something right out of The Office. So I think that we're trying to deal with some of these really sophisticated issues that we have in our society with these very ham-fisted approaches that actually end up backfiring. They teach students that they're fragile, that they can't have discourse along lines of differences, and that I think ultimately end up decreasing genuine candor as opposed to increasing it.
Mary Kay on Facebook says, couple this with the trend to remove tenure from our UW system here in Wisconsin, and this takes on a completely different tone. Could the trend toward protecting our poor students from supposedly scary and unpleasant things just be another tactic to control academics from actually encouraging students to think?
That's a very interesting question. We've written actually quite a bit on what's going on at the University of Wisconsin, and we at FIRE are very concerned about it. I do think that the larger issue here that does unite some of these issues is what could be called sort of like corporatism. You know, basically universities viewed as sort of mega corporations. Megan McArdle wrote a great piece in Bloomberg View talking about that part of the reason why you end up with this sort of, you know, coddling of students, that's not exactly my favorite term, even though it's the title of the article, is that they're viewed as, you know, revenue sources. They're viewed as the consumer. The consumer's always right. So even if they want to be protected from things that we know it's important for them to be exposed to, we defer to the consumer's choice. So I think university professors are running into this environment that is thought of more in corporate market terms, that doesn't always jive with an idea of a university where, ideally, or at least in the past, the idea was that it was up to university professors to govern the university and to make decisions based first and foremost on pedagogy.
Yeah. On the other hand, couldn't the argument be made that it's mostly conservatives who think our college campuses are indoctrinating our students to be, you know, liberals? And that therefore, you know, that conservatives would welcome more conservative viewpoints.
That conservatives would welcome more, I'm sure they would.
Yeah, so it's not necessarily, I was just presenting a different point of view to Mary Kay on Facebook, who thought that this was protecting our poor students from scary and unpleasant things is not necessarily, that would be more of a liberal thing than a conservative thing.
Yeah, the sort of simple binary between liberal and conservative, I think, sometimes doesn't do the whole issue justice, and I watch it as being sometimes a little bit sad how quickly people will line up as soon as they think it's the other side doing the wrong thing. It's one of the reasons why I was so happy to write this with Jonathan Haidt, who actually studies the American culture war, in detail. He wrote a book called The Righteous Mind, which is a book I have to recommend to everybody. My organization, FIRE, has defended, you know, professors on the left, on the right, students on the left, right, middle, and a lot of these cases, frankly, are relatively apolitical. I definitely, I think it's pretty clear on college campuses you're more likely to get in trouble for some opinions other than others, but there's a whole category of cases where really all someone has done is criticize the way the university is run, for example, or a professor, and that's, it can sometimes really be the easiest way to get yourself in trouble.
So are we coddling college students? Are we protecting them too much from ideas that they don't like or that somehow scare them? Are we protecting them too much? We are talking with the co-author of the cover story in the September Atlantic, The Coddling of the American Mind. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Should college students be warned about the domestic abuse content in The Great Gatsby or the racial violence in Things Fall Apart? We are talking with a guest who says trigger warnings like this and the policing of microaggressions on campuses may be contributing to an erosion of critical thinking skills of our college students, and he is the co-author of the article, which is in the September cover story of The Atlantic, Are We Coddling College Students? And we welcome your input, your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. The article is The Coddling of the American Mind. Wondering if we are coddling our college students' minds. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Greg Lukianoff is a constitutional lawyer and the president and CEO of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. Our next caller is Rick in Twin Lakes. Hi, Rick.
Hi, Joy. Great conversation. Thanks for taking my call. I think that's a very worthy thing that we're investigating. And, Joy, I appreciate that you brought up with Craig, and, Greg, you responded about, well, where do we draw the line? Because people find things offensive, and those can lead to just kind of a general life environment for folks who are outsiders. And the colleges, I think, are attuning students to the fact that these microaggressions are not just kind of little one-off things that people should brush off. They can be part of a much larger system. I hope you'll keep exploring where do we draw the line. You know, when students protest somebody like Condoleezza Rice, her name came up, coming on campus, and Greg and others would argue, let her come on campus and why don't we debate? Well, I would argue that Condoleezza Rice has a huge megaphone that enables her to get her points out there. And I'm not just picking on her, but others. It's often powerful people that complain about this, especially white men complain that the campus should be open. I don't think Condoleezza Rice is struggling to get her message out there. She can write a book and it'll have millions in sales anytime. The students on the campus who protested against her, however, have very little power. Their voices are very tiny. So the fact that they engage in their own free speech to say we do not want her on our campus, to me, is just that. It's the relatively powerless engaging in free speech against the very powerful.
Now, what about that, Greg?
Well, it's been very interesting seeing some of the initial reactions to the article, and I have to say that so far, of all of the first bunch of people who mentioned privilege and that it's easy for white men, have all been white men, and I think it's an interesting phenomenon that I've run into. Now, when it comes to Condoleezza Rice, I've also thought it was really interesting that the caller actually did three different things that I've seen repeated over. The first one was that. The second one was fixating right on Condoleezza Rice, because people know that they hate Condoleezza Rice and they don't want her to be on campus. And what I always try to point out is that we've done research of all the different points of view that people are trying to exclude from campus. And you can pick any individual case and say, I really dislike this one particular person, and that person should not be allowed to speak on campus, and the students are right to protest. But when you look at it as a phenomenon, and you look at how hard it is in some cases to keep your invitation, if you happen to be a genuine contrarian on a college campus, that's not healthy. I don't really, Condoleezza Rice, is not the most important issue here. The idea that we have an environment where students are not taught, wait a second, I should probably hear this person out. Maybe they might have something interesting to say. Maybe the fact that I disagree with them so badly or think they did something so wrong is all the more reason to hear from them to find out if I'm missing something. And this is what's at the center of so much of what I write about in freedom and a lot of my work, including my book Freedom from Speech, is we should be cultivating in students epistemic humility, a constant idea that they can learn from virtually anything and anyone, even if what they learn is that they were right all along about that speaker that they hated or didn't actually want on campus. Now, of course, there was also, lastly, there was the where do we draw the line? I'm a First Amendment lawyer. I think that the limitations placed on free speech of the categorical approach, libel, threats, for example, actual harassment, make a good deal of sense. I think that it's actually very well thought out in what we allow and what we don't. But I don't think we're currently facing an environment where we're under policing speech on campus. I think we're over policing it.
Are the students though expressing their free speech by saying, hey, we can read Condoleezza Rice's book if we want to, we can see her on TV all the time, we don't want her on our campus, and therefore that's their free speech?
They are, and I'm very clear about this in the many articles that I write about it, is students absolutely have the free speech rights to protest whomever they want. However, if their goal is not to protest them and simply to make sure that speaker does not speak on that campus, that's where we differ. I think it's very hard to have a university function as a proper marketplace of ideas if students' goals are not to express their point of view or to protest or to picket, but rather that person should not be speaking on my campus because I don't like their ideas.
A caller, Bob, wanted to know if training students to talk about diversity at an earlier age, students often don't until they get into college, that might make it easier to engage critically with these issues when the students arrive in college, that maybe when we're talking about solutions here, that we talk about these issues much earlier in their academic life.
I think it depends on how they're trained, and I think currently the way that the way that we're training students, I think, is actually to have a fairly narrow idea of how we're supposed to talk to each other. So, for example, that University of New Hampshire policy, or the microaggression list as explained by the University of California system, which Eugene Volokh, brought to light, included things like, saying America is a melting pot, is a microaggression, for example, or saying that, the best person got the job is a microaggression. And it presumes from the get-go that there is sort of an elite number of people, usually a small group of educated people, who know how we should actually talk to each other. And I always find that to be a deeply classist idea. It very much reminds me of sort of the Anthony Comstock idea that really only the elite and educated know how to talk across lines of difference, which I think is often the complete opposite of what is true. So if you're teaching students to be open, if you're teaching them to listen, if you're teaching them to be curious, that's wonderful. But if you're actually giving them a list of things that they shouldn't say, chances are that's really just going to reflect the values of the person writing the code.
Yeah. Let's so what else do we do about this? How do we uncoddle the American mind?
Well, I think that some of the steps that we recommend in the piece, is one, learn a little bit about cognitive distortions. I think that we'd have much more productive discussions as a society and as a university if people stop for a minute to ask themselves, am I catastrophizing? Am I personalizing? Am I labeling? Am I engaged in all of these things that sort of distort the way we argue with each other? I also think, frankly, having more debate, having students actually participate in debates, particularly if they're have an assignment in which they're supposed to take the opposite point of view that they actually have, I think that can go a long way to having people understand that you're not necessarily stupid or evil if you disagree. And I also think that people should adopt Jeff Stone's University of Chicago statement, which my assistant actually just tweeted out to your Twitter account.
Oh, great. Thank you very much. We'll let people react to that as well. So what if we don't do these things? What does it mean for not just the college students, but what does it mean for society as a whole?
Well, that's the angle of the article on coddling the American mind, and as I explained, it's very personal, it's very dear to my heart. I think, obviously, discourse suffers. We become more polarized. We increasingly talk to just those we already agree with, which is not good for intellectual development. But the more profound thing that we talk about in this particular article is I think we actually might be turning a situation that could be so wonderful into a situation where we're training students in habits that will make them anxious and depressed the rest of their life when they don't have to be.
Well, we have a few more minutes with our guest. If you have some solutions or recommendations to uncoddle the American mind, or if you want to ask more about this or challenge our guest, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Greg Lukianoff. He is a constitutional lawyer. He is the president and CEO of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, co-author of The Coddling of the American Mind, which is September's cover story in The Atlantic. Karen on Facebook says, I think this is a result of kids that were young in the 90s that received awards for everything they did. No one's feelings should be hurt. No one is ever wrong. We are going to lose the art of learning how to debate. So she thinks we're going to lose the art of learning how to debate.
Yep. I think she's right. And it's also, you know, we're just not teaching it. And that's one of the reasons why I think something that could make such a big difference is proper Oxford-style debates where you have to take on the opinion you disagree with. But that's almost impossible to do if you create an environment in which you believe that the worst thing that could happen to someone is being offended. And it's something that, you know, I make no apologies for, Fire makes no apologies for. Sometimes being offended is what happens when you have your deepest beliefs challenged. And if you make it through 4 years of college and have never been offended, you should demand your money back.
Alex on Facebook says, this really has multiple roots, all bad. I think he is completely correct in saying you can't break it down into simple liberal conservative opposition. My cousin attends the UW system currently, and the current group vying for most injured status are the third wave feminists. My mother, a second wave feminist, was shocked to hear the things that they were saying. As a liberal who marched for equal rights, she couldn't imagine having loud discussions banned because it might hurt somebody's feelings. So apparently Alex is blaming feminists.
Oh, that's not the way I read that. I think there's a generational fight among feminists currently that I think is very hot and profound. Whether you're that you'll hear about from people like Nadine Strossen or Michelle Goldberg write about this, and it is a real question of like what does the term mean and what does its values represent. And I do think that's a very real fight at the moment that is not blaming feminism. It's actually trying to figure out which version people want to go with.
Let's go to Steve in Eau Claire. Hi, Steve.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. Go ahead.
Yeah, I teach at a university here in Eau Claire. I'm a political scientist, and a lot of my courses deal with ethnicity, nationalism, topics of religion. And this fall, I'm putting a trigger warning in my syllabus. And surprisingly, occasionally I have a conservative student who'll write a nasty anonymous note. But
right.
In my classes dealing with these topics, minority students, black, African-American students, Asian students, they like these discussions. It happens to be the white liberal progressive students who are the most insulted and get angry, which is a real surprise.
I have completely noticed that exact same thing, and definitely I think it also goes along class lines, that when it comes to the people who are actually in a lot of cases, this is a gross generalization, but the people that I have found that have called for the most speech codes were, frankly, some of the richest, most elite people I met at for my time at Stanford, for example, where it was really kind of peculiar that I used to work in inner-city high schools in Washington, D.C. I used to work in factories as a kid. I had lots of exposure to people from all sorts of different backgrounds, and the ones that seem the most determined to police speech and with a sort of patronizing sense of protecting this other group were usually some of the most elite people I'd ever met in my life.
Victoria on Facebook says, this has emerged out of political correctness run amok. I also believe that people are often looking for a reason to be offended.
I think that's absolutely true, and that's motivated reasoning. There's even a term for it in psychology, where essentially, if you want, it's a little bit a part of human nature. Like if you want to win an argument and you can't figure out a way to do it, or you want to do it sort of lazily, sort of like on the cheap, you can just say that you're offended these days. And when people start learning that they have an ultimate trump card to debate, they're going to use it. So I do think that sometimes we have to realize that sometimes these defenses are used entirely sincerely, that people are absolutely serious, that they feel marginalized and they feel offended. And other times it gets used as just a tactic to win a debate.
Barbara in Superior, go ahead.
Hello. Yes, I'm saying the question of universities not allowing Condoleezza Rice or Christine Lagarde to speak, these are people of privilege. University students, perhaps some are, but others are not. So I don't think it's an issue of conservative versus liberal people.
What do you think it is an issue of? She thinks it's the have versus the have-nots, Greg.
Oh, you're asking me. I thought you were asking her. I think that there are a lot of dynamics all running at once. I definitely do think that there is such a thing as political correctness, and it is possible to get in trouble for being on PC. But I think it's a lot more complex than that. And I think you end up with this sort of slippery slope issue that's genuine. Not it's why I explained it's not a fallacy at all. when it comes to freedom of speech is you end up with this phenomena that Eugene Volokh calls censorship envy, that if you get to get your speaker disinvited or you get to get that opinion shut down that you dislike, well, I should be able to get that too. And unfortunately, that's one of the reasons why having a very broad and fair definition of, okay, everyone gets to speak, you don't have to like each other, you don't have to get along, but everyone gets to speak, or else it pretty quickly leads to a race to the bottom.
We have less than 30 seconds. Are you optimistic this trend can reverse?
Am I optimistic? I'm generally optimistic about an awful lot of stuff, but there's a great deal of work to do to reverse the trend.
Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Greg Lukianoff is a constitutional lawyer, the president and CEO of the Foundation for Individual Rights and Education, and the co-author of The Coddling of the American Mind in the Atlantic, which you can find on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Thanks to Christy Taylor and to Elizabeth Deliquest for producing and directing this program. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.